Hello and welcome to the OMFIF podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's episode, we talk about gender diversity in economics. This is Donai Kiriakopoulou from London, and today I welcome three guest speakers on the podcast. So we have Vicky Price, former head of the UK Government Economic Service, now chief economic advisor at the Centre for Economics and Business Research, also a member of the OMFIF Advisory Board, and author of Why Women Need Quotas. We have Amelia Cox, co-chair of the Women's Leadership Student Interest Group at the University of Cambridge Judge Business School, and also formerly a senior consultant within financial services at Accenture, and Hannah Bargawi, senior lecturer at the Department of Economics at the University of London's School of Oriental and African Studies. Thank you all three of you for joining us today. Welcome to the podcast. So this is a series that we've been doing on gender balance and gender diversity in economics and finance. This is the second episode in this podcast series. In last week's episode, we focused on gender diversity in central banks. I was speaking to the Deputy Governor of the Central Bank of Ireland, and this was based on a project that OMFIF has been working on, a research project that we've been doing now for a number of years, looking at gender diversity in these policymaking institutions and central banks, as well as sovereign funds and pension funds. What we find there is that women tend to be very underrepresented in that sector, much more than in politics, for example, or even in business. And I'd like to start by asking all three of you to say, what are your views in terms of how this is heading? Because we are seeing more and more women be represented in economics in terms of young student graduates, as well as in entry-level positions. But there is also a pyramid shape. As they move further into more senior positions, women tend to drop out. And do you think it's only a question of time, as we now have more equality in the lower levels, that as these cohorts progress, we will see a closing of the gender pay gap as they become more senior? Or do you think that there are more systemic factors at play that create these challenges for women in reaching this top position? So Vicky, perhaps we can start with you. What do you think? Is it a matter of time, or do we need to do something about it?
There's no doubt that things are getting better generally for women, and they're getting more senior positions, but it's been very, very slow. If you look at any section of the economy, and if you look at a particular environment such as the financial sector, but if you also look at business more generally, what you find is that there are very few senior executives who are women, and the progress has been so slow that unless something happens to improve that pace, we're still going to end up in 20 or 30 years' time with women being seriously still underrepresented in senior positions. And I think something needs to happen in terms of greater push to ensure that this pyramid that you described actually becomes a lot flatter, and that women are able to move into positions more easily that they deserve.
Thank you. What about you, Amelia? I mean, at the Judge Business, what is the makeup there of the MBA cohort? Are women going into these sectors, into finance, also from your experience in Accenture? How do you see that pyramid shape manifesting itself in the financial sector and the ambitions also for young women and the policies that are there to support them to grow and rise into more senior positions?
Yeah, so I agree with Vicky that the pace has been slow based on my experience at Accenture, but it's definitely changing. I think one of the key important factors that has helped over the last few years that I've noticed is mentorship. So I have a number of female mentors more senior than me within Accenture, and it's been a great example to have those people rising through the ranks, which will hopefully have a more trickle-down effect within the organisation. At the Judge Business School, we also have a mentoring program set up by the Women's Leadership Interest Group, where we're partnering with Women in Business, which is a society for undergrads, and we're pairing people up based on specific skill sets. So this is hopefully something that we can do at the university level to help bring people together and help build confidence in women that they are able to take forward bigger roles and look into the kind of business and financial space longer term.
Thank you. And what about you, Hannah? What do you think? How is your experience from the students you're seeing, but also in terms of the academic literature that you're reviewing? Are things getting better? What kind of policies may we need to ensure that women are reaching top positions?
Yeah, thank you. I think, as Vicky and Amelia have said, I think within the sort of business world, things are changing to some degree. I think within that, there is still occupational segregation, so there are certain roles that women perform and certain roles that men perform, even once they get into more senior positions. So looking just at economics as a subject that's studied at university, actually the picture there is a little bit more bleak. And while subjects, sort of STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, math, have been making steady progress since the 2000s in increasing the proportion of female undergraduate students. Economics is the one subject where that hasn't happened, and actually we've been seeing a regression in terms of the proportion of female undergraduate students at the national level, and this is a particularly stark picture for the US and for the UK. Now, I know that certain institutions can buck that trend, and we're fortunate that we have been able to do that. And I think Amelia's right. I do think that role models and mentorship schemes can have a positive part in that. I know at SOAS we have a 50-50 staff ratio on gender lines. So that, I think, does help that students see more women also teaching finance, business, macroeconomics as subjects that maybe traditionally they may not have picked. I think there's also interesting research on why this is. So why are we getting women perhaps not choosing economics? And with that, there's some interesting research that shows that this is not an area of math putting women off, which is maybe the usual argument that's made. Instead, it seems to be something about the sort of feedback they receive and how female students respond to that feedback in their first year. So there was some work done by Claudia Golding, among others, who found that actually first-year undergraduate students, female students, tend to deselect out of economics very quickly on the back of receiving a grade B or lower, whereas male students don't tend to do that, and they will stick with economics independent of their results in their first year. So I think there's something interesting there to unpick a little bit further. I think there's probably, it's not just the leaky pipeline, there's perhaps something else going on beyond that as well.
Thanks, Hannah. That's very interesting, and also dispelling the myth, as you say, that it's not just about maths and there's other factors at play, but also very rightly pointing out the fact that it's also about perceptions and about role models and what can universities do there in terms of perhaps bringing in female speakers from the professional world that are economists, that are in the finance sector, that can show younger students that these careers are indeed possible and that can be successful. I think that's very important. But within the economics itself, what also do you see that in terms of the subjects that women tend to choose? Is there a difference there in terms of men choosing different parts of economics that may lead to more high-paying careers, for example? What is your experience there, Hannah, from SOAS?
I wanted to say actually at the beginning also, this is not just a gender problem. I think there's a general diversity issue within economics. So this is about economics not necessarily doing a good job at representing society more broadly. And this is particularly important given that this is a social science. I know economists sometimes like to compare themselves to hard sciences, but ultimately this is about society and the priorities that society has. And I think what is interesting there is the experiences that different people have also then leads to them having different interests. So we find that a lot of female students, but also students from Black and ethnic minority backgrounds, tend to veer towards development economics, applied microeconomics, behavioral economics, so subjects that perhaps have a greater social application and don't tend to prioritize or specialize in macroeconomics and in finance to the same degree. So I think, as you say, in terms of what can be done, I think it is important to think about role models and who teaches some of those subjects that perhaps are traditionally chosen more by boys and men. It's also about how those subjects are taught and how they're assessed. And I think that's an interesting aspect of this. So we at SOAS have been experimenting quite a lot with moving away from traditional exam assessments and actually doing things where we are showing the real world application and also the relevance to society and also to businesses in terms of the sort of skills they're looking for. So that involves, for example, rather than just asking students to analyze data, we actually get students to generate that data. So ask them to do their own surveys, do a group project where they need to work together to collect that data, then analyze it, and then present that to the rest of their student body. And that is something that actually all students benefit from. This is not something that is just for one group more than another. But that's something that we're finding seems to show some quite good results.
I agree with all that, if I can come in, Vicky, here. Just to say that, of course, the way that it's taught, the way that the subject is taught is very, very important. And there is a lot of evidence that suggests that earlier on, we're talking now about schools and what it is that people choose to do as A-level, the subject is perceived by students to be very masculine, the way it is taught and the way it's presented to them, which is interesting in itself. And the maths idea, I agree that it's not the only explanatory factor, but we mustn't forget that in fact, what happens is that girls generally tend not to do further maths. In fact, it's only 2% that do, the ones that have done maths already. And there is a perception generally that economics is a very mathematical subject. And I do remember when I was head of the Government Economic Service that we used to go around the various universities telling them, we don't actually have much use of people who come out of various universities with loads and loads of mathematical economics skills, because we can't actually put them to good use in policy making. We need different people who've done things like cost-benefit analysis, appraisals, who look at issues that matter, like regional inequality and so on. Things that we've just been hearing from others may be more attractive to women, but actually for the boys as well, just show the way in which economics can be put to use and be applied in real life in ways that perhaps they hadn't perceived before. And we need to do an awful lot more of that to explain away, if you like, this perception that it's a sort of subject which remains quite theoretical and requires all sorts of attributes for the people who take it, which lots of people don't want to really have or don't have themselves or don't think they have, such as being incredibly good at further maths.
Thanks, Vicky. Definitely the quantitative side, but also the brand problem of economics that you've so well identified, that people tend to think of men in suits, tend to think of it as a very masculine field, and finance as well. And it'd be good to hear also from you, Amelia. Hannah spoke a lot about the way things are taught in SOAS and the kind of initiatives that are there, more from the finance perspective at the business school. How do you see that? And also in terms of how things are taught, how we attract women to enter those fields. What are your views there?
The one thing that has been very prevalent on the MBA so far is that it's very much promoted as a learning platform to explore lots of new topics. So although I have a traditional kind of background in consulting within financial services, I'm using this time to delve further into the details of behind private equity, new venture finance, business plan creation, so stuff that I haven't necessarily touched on before. The reason why this is so open for me to be able to explore these are because of the, I guess, the theme we were touching on earlier was moving away from traditional grading systems. The one thing that the MBA does is that we have a number of group projects, and within those projects we have very, very diverse groups. So I'm working with engineers, marketers, people who've worked with NGOs before, and it's a fantastic way to bring together lots of different perspectives under group projects without the traditional grading. So it makes me and my colleagues feel more compelled to take on a more finance or quant heavy subject. So that's something that's been really beneficial, and I know a lot of my colleagues have expressed has been very helpful for them. Talking about broader careers within the Women's Leadership Interest Group, we are partnering with lots of other interest groups across Judge Business School. So we are bringing in speakers and panels within finance. We have a fintech one upcoming with entrepreneurship and allowing women to pitch their ideas. And it's just creating an environment to learn and explore and be able to build confidence in areas which maybe haven't been exposed to before, which has been fantastic.
I'd like also to turn a little bit to the more practical elements. I mean, it's great to have this learning environments and the opportunities to collaborate with other groups, but what about the things that matter for women's career progression on a practical level? So what can legislators actually do to encourage and support women to grow in their careers? So, for example, when we think about maternity leave arrangements or even quotas or flexible working arrangements, how can we ensure greater diversity? And what can also be the benefits of such policies for the economy in terms of actually improving productivity, improving access of employers to a greater talent pool, and effectively improving economic output and raising the potential economic growth of an economy? How can we make the business case for diversity more effective? So, Vicky, I know you've written a book about quotas. Perhaps you can start us off with some of these issues around the policies and what governments can do.
There is no doubt that productivity will be helped if people with particular skills which they have developed and for which we've paid to a considerable extent as taxpayers, and during the time of acquiring them, they've spent a lot of time in studying and then bringing some of these experiences and talents onto the workplace. It's very important that they don't then disappear, because obviously productivity suffers very significantly as a result. And there is a business case. I think it's well known that if you have more diversity, but also if you use the skills that are available and you don't lose them and you keep the talent, you don't have to try and bring new people in. It costs you a lot. If you have retention problems and so on, you can, over a period of time, be considerably more attractive to anyone who wants to perhaps work there, so you can attract better employees. And also, there is evidence that it's a better managed company run, and it represents a lot more closely what the general population is made of too. The studies have not been completely conclusive in terms of causality. In other words, if you look at a company, is it making better profits because it has more women in senior positions or on the board? You can't tell whether this is the case because they have more women, or whether they're already the type of company that is doing quite well and therefore can take risks and have more women in senior positions, which is a terrible thing to be saying, but we haven't quite sorted that out. But there is increasing amount of evidence that says, in any case, across the economy, if you're looking at macro and micro issues, that skills are important. If you have those skills in the workplace, as an economy, you'll do better. So there is a case, there is a business case in terms of firms, if you like, but there's also a wider case for the economy as a whole. You can do all sorts of things. I mean, I've suggested in my book that quotas for senior positions, not on the board, which I don't think makes much difference in terms of how a company is run, but for senior positions and senior executive positions would help. Obviously, they have to be different in different sectors, particularly if we're starting from zero, if you like, or from very low base. And they have to be achieved over a period of time. And then once the cultural change happens, then you just get rid of those regulations. And a company looking for senior people to fitting into various roles will have a wider range to choose from, and inevitably the woman will be just as good as the man, so you'll move naturally towards having that sort of equality, if you like, appearing because you've kept people working in your organization. How you do it, you touch an eye on method, you put the quota so that it actually happens. Firms have to do various things, including possibly be much kinder to women who want to go off and have children or even run a different life, irrespective of whether they have children or not, much more flexibility. And if you do that, then you also encourage the men to have a better life. So it requires a change of culture, which you wouldn't do normally, however much some companies say they're already doing it, because it requires investments. It's a long-term strategy, and we are very short-term oriented in this capitalist society in which we live, whether we like it or not. But there are a lot of studies beginning to show that better maternity pay actually keeps women at work. They don't disappear. They continue to then want to work for that company. So if you actually also provide better childcare, cheaper childcare is the case in some countries, particularly in Northern Europe, then you have much better retention and women have better career prospects as a result. So there is actually a lot you can do, but it needs to be enforced, if you like, or at least encouraged by regulation that moves you towards achieving that goal.
So it goes back to the fundamental issue of economics. It's all about incentives, isn't it? How do we make these incentives for focusing more on the long-term benefits as opposed to the short-term oriented vision that you described? Hannah-Amelia, do you have anything to add on any of these questions, on policies, on arrangements to support women in their careers, perhaps from Accenture, or any other comments on this?
If I could just come in on that, I agree with everything Vicky said. And I think there's something interesting in terms of OMFIF's interest in this, in terms of public financial institutions in particular, because I think there's the bottom line argument that seems to have kind of be gaining a lot of traction, including among the IMF and the World Bank. But I think also public financial institutions need to be responding to societal questions and issues. And I think by having greater diversity in the individuals in those institutions, we also will find that actually they may pose different questions. They may find different ways of answering those questions. They might start to question that policies have a different impact on different groups. And rather than leaving that to sort of niche groups to do that, I know the Women's Budget Group, for example, does a great job at analysing the gender impact of different policies. But I think it will be great to see institutions themselves begin to do some of that. And I think that will come with greater diversity within those institutions. I think in terms of how we get there, again, I agree with all the points that Vicky made. I think what's interesting is just to pick up on the last point she said about unpaid work and increasing maternity and care policies and offering childcare, and the countries that do seem to do that well happen to be also the countries where we have greater equality in paid work as well. So I think often we try to address just one side of the coin by looking just at how can we get more women into paid work without perhaps addressing to the same extent the other side, which is maybe how do we actually redistribute and think about some of that unpaid work and who's going to take on that work. It's not going to just be left behind. So redistributing that both in terms of the role for the state, for men, for companies. So I think that would be the bit that I would perhaps urge. There needs to be a bit more work dealing with unpaid workloads.
Thank you, Hannah, and thanks also for introducing the issue of the public institutions as well. That's very important, and that's what our research focuses on, and I'd encourage all of our listeners to look into the report that we're publishing on this as well. Thank you. And just as we now come to the end of the podcast, I'd also like to raise the question of why does diversity actually matter? We've been talking so much over the past half an hour or so about encouraging women's progression in finance, in economics. Does that actually play a role to have diversity in gender, in other types of diversity when it comes to decision making, especially in policy making institutions such as central banks, for example, but also in the private sector, in finance? If we have people with good academic and professional qualifications, does it matter the background, the gender, and other elements of diversity? I mean, of course, Vicky made the point earlier that it's also about expanding the talent pool and making sure that we have both women and men to choose from for employers. But are there any inherent benefits to diversity? Amelia, what do you think?
Yes, I think diversity is integral to better decision making. We can talk about board level, but I think just across an organization, there's obviously lots of research regarding the kind of correlation between business performance and diversity within an organization. And I guess to me, kind of, there's two main reasons. So one of which, a diversity of backgrounds really make a company kind of more adaptable to the changing environment. As we see, especially in the business world, things are changing so rapidly, especially with technology. Having that variety and the diversity is really, really helpful with that. I guess secondly, when companies are looking at their customers, it's really important to have people within the organization that represent that. So the people that are going to be affected by the organization, how do they think, what are their perspectives, and having that diversity within the organization reflects the real world demographic and therefore can reinstate views of the customer, which is obviously very important.
Thank you. What about you, Vicky and Hannah? Do you have to add to that? Do you agree with Amelia?
Of course, I agree entirely. I can only imagine that one can make better decisions and focus on the things that really matter if you have more diversity in terms of the people who make the decisions. And in reality, if you're not able to make the decisions, then you're not really empowered. So you can do whatever you want in terms of shouting about it, getting all sorts of government departments to do the right thing and so on. But at the end of the day, if you're not up there, then you're not really achieving an awful lot. And my view is that you can only really get to the decision-making position if you have the economic empowerment that allows you to get there. And that's why, unfortunately, one has to start with ensuring that women stay at work and that they're able to rise through the ranks. Of course, but in politics, you can move a little bit faster and impose quotas which discriminate as of the word go. So in other words, you do it immediately, whereas the suggestion that I was making about business and also another, well, perhaps public institutions more generally, another area of the economy, you perhaps have to wait a little bit longer and have all those incentives there that encourage that to happen. But in politics, you can say that a certain percentage has to be women, a certain percentage has to be maybe ethnic minorities or whatever, and disability, which again, when I used to work for the government, we took very seriously in terms of ensuring that we had a reasonable representation of people and they weren't barred from joining the civil service or the public sector. That was pretty good news. But you can move faster in some areas than others. And maybe, therefore, whatever policies are then instituted, such as childcare facilities, maternity pay and so on, might happen faster so that the women can stay and then eventually take the rightful place. But not just the women, but also, and if you sort it out for women, who after all are more than 50% of the population, then I would imagine that the cultural changes you've introduced will also impact positively on minorities.
Thank you, Vicky. Definitely, we shouldn't just be thinking about gender diversity and we shouldn't only be thinking about this around International Women's Day in March. And Hannah, do you have anything to add to that? How does diversity matter? Why does it matter? What does the academic literature say there?
Actually, I was going to make a sort of perhaps slightly tangential point, but I think it's an important one for your listeners to bear in mind. And that's the point about the gender story in particular, because I think often some argue for greater gender diversity because they are making a point that there's something biological or innately different about women and men. And I think I would argue that that's not the case. And it's really about coming with different lived experiences that mean you come with something different. So it's not to say that women are innately softer and have a different side to them to men that brings something good to an organization. But it's the fact that we have different experiences that mean we therefore do ask different questions, offer different solutions, etc. So I think I just wanted to bring that in there just to remind people of that.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting perspective. Perhaps it suggests that over time, as we do have more equality on all forms of experiences, perhaps diversity will become less relevant as a result because it will become more equal. We'll have to see. But thank you all three of you for joining us today. It's been great to speak to you and to learn from you, to hear what your respective institutions are doing, what your views are about what we should do to support women more in their career progression, whether economics as a brand problem for women, and also what can legislators do in terms of providing supportive policies. Thank you very much, and also to all of our listeners. This podcast is part of our Gender Diversity in Public Institutions series, and tomorrow, on the 7th of March, which is also the eve of International Women's Day, we will be launching our Gender Balance Index research at the Swiss Embassy in London. We hope to see you all there. We will be presenting the findings of this year's report. We will also be further launching the research at the IMF World Bank annual meetings in Washington, D.C. in April. And again, we hope to see some of you there. Thank you.